Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode number 124, recorded Thursday, December 15th, 2011. The Encultured Brain. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated Sync. Sync gives you versatile access to music, podcasts, and more from just about any device. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki, and this is the show where you get to dig deep into subjects, an entire hour on a single subject in the sciences with an expert on the topic. And today, the digging is going to be a lot of fun because we're digging into brains, my favorite subject, but not just brains, into human culture. So it's actually really, we're digging into the love child of neuroscience and anthropology, the field of neuroanthropology with Dr. Daniel Lende of South Florida University and the PLOS blog called Neuroanthropology. But first, a few science headlines. What's going on in science this week? The Mars Science Laboratory is now some 32 million miles from Earth and well on its way to Mars. It recently started collecting data using its radiation assessment detector, or RAD, about how much radiation from solar flares and other sources reaches the craft interior. This is for preparation for a future manned trip to Mars. The Mars Science Laboratory will reach its destination in about 8 months. The EPA released a fracking report this week. It describes studies done in Wyoming, which provide a clear link between fracking procedures and water contamination. From the report, inorganic and organic constituents associated with hydraulic fracturing have contaminated groundwater at and below the depth used for domestic water supply, and gas production activities have likely enhanced gas migration at and below depths used for domestic water supply and to domestic wells in the area of investigation. Seismologists have plotted the epicenters of recent quakes in Ohio, normally a quake-free zone, and found them to coincide with a 9,000-foot hydraulic fracturing disposal well. Researchers at the Kyoto Institute for Advanced Study have created the largest computer simulation of the universe to date. It consisted of 374 billion particles in a box about two-thirds the size of the known universe, or 10 gigaparsecs across, and took 20 days of computing to complete on the 25th largest supercomputer in the world. The goal is to simulate the evolution of a universe made mostly of cold, dark matter to see if it ends up like ours. CERN scientists staged a press conference this week to report on a new analysis of more data from the Large Hadron Collider with respect to the search for the Higgs boson. The elusive particle remains hidden, but the scientists are optimistic that they are solidly on its trail. Maybe sometime next year we'll actually find the Higgs. Publishing in Nature Physics, researchers from Stuttgart and the Max Planck Institute have detailed the creation of the smallest Stirling engine in history. Consisting of a single microscopic particle controlled by lasers, I love anything with laser beams, the heat engine is so small that its work output is randomly affected by Brownian motion. And a study in biology letters suggests that it might be wise to forego the waxing of body hair if you live in an area where parasites like bedbugs are a problem, say New York City, for example. The study, which involved the placement of bedbugs on shaved and unshaved forearms, found that, quote, fine body hair enhances the detection of ectoparasites through the combined effects of, one, increasing the parasite's search time, and, two, enhancing its detection. So that does it for the headlines this week. If you are traveling to the Big Apple for the holidays, I suggest skipping body hair removal. But remember to take your entertainment with you. And you know who makes that easy? Ford. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring Available Sync. Sync's entertainment features enable you to access music and podcasts from most devices, including iPods, mobile phones, tablets, or flash drives. And with Sync with My Ford Touch, you can play videos or display photos from your digital cameras and portable game devices when your vehicle is in park. It's all made possible through a versatile media hub which supports a convenient variety of devices for your music and entertainment, such as wired connections from just about any device through USB ports, SD slots, and even RCA jacks. Or wireless access via Bluetooth for Bluetooth-enabled devices. Just connect your devices and play. Once your device is connected, you can use Sync's voice activation feature to play what you want. Just a few of the simple voice commands are play genre. You can choose rock, for example. Play Adele, if you choose your artist. Play track Rolling in the Deep, if that's the song that you want to listen to. Also available is Sync with My Ford Touch HD Radio. This features iTunes tagging, which lets you tag a song that you like on the radio, transfer the information to your iPod, and then purchase the song directly from iTunes at a later time, allowing it's a pretty easy system. Sync's versatile entertainment features are available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. Now I'd like to welcome our guest to the show. Daniel Lende is an associate professor in anthropology at the University of South Florida. He is trained in medical, psychological, and biological anthropology and public health at Emory University. His main research interests are substance use and abuse, the intersection of anthropology and neuroscience, behavioral health, community-based research, and public and applied anthropology. Daniel, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Kiki, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So first question, neuroanthropology, obviously this is combining neuroscience or brain science, the nervous system science, and anthropology. But can you really explain what it's all about and how this is really different from other similar areas of, say, cultural neuroscience or cognitive anthropology?
That's a great question. And I think where neuroanthropology started with two things, was recognizing that neuroplasticity has really changed our views of brain function over the past 10 to 15 years and gives us a basis to really think about the variation that is being increasingly documented by fields like cultural neuroscience across the globe. And anthropology adds that and wants to incorporate that by saying we know a lot about cultural variation and about biological variation from the two sides of anthropology. And we need to be able to put those three areas together, neuroplasticity, understanding of the match of human variation and environments and the power of culture, into a new synthesis that we call neuroanthropology.
Excellent. Well, how did you get interested in this coming from anthropology? And I guess even before that, what's your history that led you into this area of study?
It's a great question. I'll go right back to your opening statement that it's a love child. And my dad was a neurosurgeon and a neuroscientist, and my mom was a poet and an actor. So I think I grew up in an environment where neuroscience and doing good science alongside interpretive approaches, art, history, were all part of things that I just experienced in my household. And then later on, I had a really good high school that gave me a lot of grounding in various areas of a scholarship, a good, you know, well-rounded education. But then when I got to college, you know, you have to specialize. And at that point, I did go into biological anthropology. And what really sort of led me back to thinking seriously about how you put together these different areas was ethnographic experience, which in this case means living abroad and spending time with different people to really get an ungrounded understanding of what life is like in a different time and place. In my case, this was living down in Colombia, in Bogota, mm-hmm. Colombia, for 3 years when I worked with kids that had drug problems. And after those 3 years, I realized I wanted to go back and do research on addiction. I thought it wasn't well understood, that anthropology had a lot to add to our understanding of addiction as a problem. But at the same time, I was very cognizant of the role of the brain, the role of biology in a problem like substance abuse. So I wanted to put all those things together.
Yeah, myself coming from a neuroscience background, I'm really, you know, for me, it's the very reductionist perspective of, you know, we have these brain pathways, the addiction pathways, of course, this is what's going to happen. But can you tell me a little bit more about your experience down there and really how anthropology brings more to bear on the study of addiction?
Yeah, a great example is I do a lot of work sort of taking neuroscience, neuroscience results and theories and trying to see if they play out in the field. And in this case, it was very clear from working with these kids that had problems that what they called anxieties or cravings were one of the main problems in addiction that they faced. And in Colombia, they actually called, they described addiction a very different way than they did in the United States. There was querer más y más, to want more and more, was sort of the way mm-hmm. they characterized it. And funny enough that I was there in the early 90s, and when I really started looking at the neuroscience, there was a new theory about addiction called incentive salience and sensitization of the mesolimbic dopamine system. And that really matched up very well with what I had seen with these kids, except for it was done with rats. So I wanted to go back down and test those theories out using epidemiological methods as well as ethnographic methods to see, well, if we take it into the field, does this neuroscience play out in the way it's being theorized? And in my work, yes, it did come out that I built a scale to test incentive salience among people, and it was one of the main predictors of addiction in my sample. But at the same time, the ethnography helped me understand how some of the ideas about incentive salience were different than what was in the literature, because they were reporting not just wanting drugs before going to use, but while they were using.
Okay, so what are some examples of incentive salience so that we can put it in perspective for the audience?
I think the best way to explain incentive salience is when you say, the way I explain to my students, if you're in the classroom and suddenly you really want that pizza, you're thinking about pizza and suddenly you have that urge just to get up and go get pizza.
Or for me, it's chocolate. Really want that chocolate now.
Right.
I don't know where it came from, but I want that chocolate now.
That sense of now, that sense of urgency and wanting, and that's really what this this mesolimbic dopamine system is about. And incentive salience more broadly, now that we're starting to realize that it's not necessarily tied to just one brain system, that it depends on context. But anyway, it's that sense of wanting, that desire, that urge that we all feel for different things.
Okay, and so in Colombia and or probably anywhere where you're dealing with people who are addicted, there's that the urgency. And was this specifically related to cocaine, or were these multiple drugs of abuse?
The kids down there use multiple drugs of abuse. Some of the worst ones were cocaine or what they call bazuco, which is basically like our crack. And I still remember very clearly one boy I worked with as a counselor, and this is really what sort of got me interested in this path of research, was he sat me down one day to try to explain to me what was the difference between what we think addiction's about and what addiction really is about, what's the most difficult things for him and for a lot of other the kids I worked with. And so he said to me, he had just relapsed and was coming off that relapse, and he said, you know, withdrawal's hard, withdrawal is really hard. It's a weekend on the bathroom floor just getting through that. But that's not the hardest thing about addiction. The hardest things are the anxieties, the cravings that come afterwards. And in his case, when he had recently felt an overwhelming urge to go use, was driven by a very interesting social situation. And so he was quite poor, and he was trying to work. He didn't have a lot of money. And he had to catch transport, a bus, public transport, back to his barrio, his place of residence in Bogota. And he didn't have money to pay for the bus, so he could sort of talk to the conductor, the bus driver, and see if he could get on the back door. The guy sometimes would open up the back door. And so he's saying he's trying to convince this bus driver to let him get on the bus. And the bus driver looks down and goes, "Hey, I remember who you are. You're that kid that used to be that really good thief. Just go steal me a watch, and I'll let you ride my bus all you want." And... This boy said to me when he started to think again about having that easy money, about going back to that old life, about all that represented to him, he felt such an urge to go use. And that was much more difficult for him to control than the withdrawal. And that ethnographic experience, that really working with people to try to understand what their problems are about and intersect that with an interdisciplinary science is... what I've been doing ever since talking with him.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, so often you have the neuroscientists in the lab who are working on the rat models of addiction or craving, and you know, you get the rat who can go hit the lever and get its cocaine or whatever you've gotten the rat addicted to, and you can have a model of what's happening in the brain or what's happening in this system, but. To actually take it into the real world and to see it in the context of people, that's a really fascinating transition.
It is, and I think we have a lot of work to do. It's a new field. It's something that's been developing over the last few years, but we're really excited about what we're going to do. First as anthropologists, but I think we're making lots of connection to neuroscientists, to psychologists. We're starting to put together interdisciplinary teams so that we can examine these same questions that are in the lab or come out of the lab in more real world settings. Lab and bench science is really important. We can't do a lot of our work without it. But to get at some of these human problems, you need to work with people in naturalistic settings.
How much does in behavior research, I know working with animals, it's the ethological approach has become really really useful, where you try and take animals where in the wild it's the best way to observe them, but you can't always control the situation, and so you create these naturalistic settings in the laboratory to be able to approximate it. Are you doing any kind of approach like that in terms of the research that you're doing?
The amazing thing about anthropology, after decades and decades of research on human variation around the world, is you can actually find these natural experiments out there. People have pushed their nervous systems in very, very interesting ways. So a lot of my work on neuroanthropology as a field has been with my colleague Greg Downey at Macquarie University. And Greg has worked particularly with capoeiristas, these Brazilian martial artists, to understand how balance works out in the real world. And unlike the sort of static modular system we often think of as balance here, which is sort of associated with how gymnasts are very rigid on balance beams, there. Their sense of balance has to be very fluid, because being a capoeirista often means you're doing these upside down cartwheels, and you have to look at your opponent who you're having this bout with, rather than looking at the ground to maintain your balance. And so he really looks at how the vestibular system and perception work together to maintain balance in a very dynamic way. And sure enough, as he starts to really dig into the neuroscience, he finds that neuroscience is meeting him halfway and is saying, yes, we can think about systems that are pushed by neuroplasticity, that can incorporate different streams of input and novel combinations. And so I think this overall idea of looking for those sort of quote-unquote natural experiments out there where culture has really pushed our ability to understand the world, to act in the world in very interesting ways is a great complement to some of the same ways we try to push and control things in a laboratory setting.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of looking at it from your anthropological basis and then combining it with the neurological side, how do you split the difference and actually get into looking at or getting ideas of what's happening within the mesolimbic system? Like how do you get to the brain?
That's the tough nut to crack right now.
Yeah.
We don't have many portable imaging machines, for example. I think you'll see over the next 5 to 10 years the development of these sort of systems, not necessarily neuroimaging, but more sort of the scalp-based things that can at least give an image of what's happening on the surface in field conditions. But I think another way that is rapidly developing that I'm actually getting more excited about just recently is the use of genetic markers as biomarkers to get a proxy for what might be happening in certain types of variation within the brain. So we're starting to understand the epigenetics behind, say, different serotonin genes and how that might be linked to depression, so on and so forth. And that science is a lot further along, and I think that will give us some proxies for what might be happening in the brain that can then be complemented with stuff that I do in terms of, building good psychometric measures and doing ethnographic work and observation.
What kind of there's something that you had brought up in some notes that you sent me about neural plasticity, and I was trying to think about how neural plasticity connected to the human experience, to the anthropological study. So we're talking about epigenetics of serotonin genes, and we know that in depression, depressed individuals often have a shrinkage of the connections between neurons compared to a normal brain. And then if you give them SSRIs, suddenly there are more connections made between neurons, and the depression seems to lift. And that's one aspect of the plasticity. But how do you discuss plasticity in the anthropological sense?
Well, I think anthropology for a long time has been open to ideas of plasticity that a lot of biological sciences have been really using a sort of universalistic approach to thinking about human variation, that we're going to find quote unquote human nature, and anthropology has been facing the tremendous variation around the world and trying to make sense of that, and we've had to develop models that capture that. And the main ways we do that is to understand that local environments, local cultures have a profound influence on the way we operate, and we've documented that biologically in terms of our bodies, and now we're starting to move on to document it in primates and now in humans. I think the route that's easiest to make for understanding how some of this does is people who are already drawing on naturalistic variation out there. I think one great example is all these studies on taxi drivers in London.
Oh, I love that work. Yeah.
Right. Best to study the knowledge. And so suddenly these people pour themselves into studying for this very intensive knowledge-based exam, have expansions in certain parts of the brain that are robust over time. But if they stop doing it, say the retired taxi drivers, you see some shrinkage, not as much as a control, but nonetheless it stays there. And I think it shows that both learning and practice really can drive the way our brains function and the way they're structured. And that same idea that the way we learn things and the way we practice things, what we say, what we do, those are ideas that anthropologists work with every day.
Yeah. You're talking about the way we practice things and how we learn stuff. Often, we talk about practice makes perfect. Repetition often leads to the formation of stronger pathways within the brain. You can get habits and certain things like I'm a nail biter, I will admit it. It's a bad habit I've had almost my entire life. But it was, I saw my mom biting her nails and I was like, I guess I'll bite my nails. That looks like fun. And it's something that's very hard to break. With your research into addiction and these other things, is there some kind of application that you're hoping to get to be able to help people figure out how to break habits, how to break addictions, how to get out of those situations where the salience for something is just so huge? The incentive right. salience is so huge that the craving begins.
I think the clearest example from my work with addiction is doing a lot of work with these adolescent kids and more recently with adults. What comes across very clearly in their descriptions of wanting and habit as well is it's really something that they can feel anxious about going to use, but ambivalent about it before they actually go use. They want to, but they know their mother is going to disapprove, or they're going to miss school, so on and so forth. But then they consistently reported kids that were using a lot of drugs that they felt more drive, more desire to use once they made the decision to go use. And then, the research is pretty clear that automatic behaviors, habitual behaviors start taking over at certain points to just sort of get them to sort of use over and over and over again. So a clear applied implication from that is you really have to help people decide not to use, to address their ambivalence. Mm-hmm. And there are good therapies for this. Motivational interviewing is actually an excellent therapy that addresses the ambivalence people have to use. But it's often framed about sort of a cognitive control. And I think what neuroanthropology is saying, this is actually happening in a series of steps. And they need to understand those steps and try to say, I need to step back now. Otherwise, I might just go on because it's a habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hopefully there could be certain behavioral tools that can be used by the person who's addicted or to be able to break that chain of events within the brain.
I think so. And I think the other thing that really needs to be addressed is, as we understand how embedded the brain is in social environments, that it doesn't all have to be on the person. It can be about improving social environments, and then that really makes a big difference. So take your example of nail biting. You did a very interesting thing. You presented it as, something you learned from your mother and something you're playful about, but you're sort of acknowledging that, it might be something you're not entirely comfortable with. You're playing with it. You're able to recognize its relationship to yourself and to sort of separate yourself from it. For a lot of people, drug use means something to them, and they're in highly stressful environments, marginalized environments, where it's really hard to do those sorts of things. And we need to provide more support for what we're learning from neuroscience and from anthropology and epidemiology to improve social environments. This will address not just problems with drugs, but a wide array of behavioral health problems that are really brain-based problems. The more we learn about how embedded the brain is in our social and cultural lives, the more emphasis I think we should put on learning how to improve and do better on the social side, address inequality, and address those things that we know make a difference in how the brain functions.
And this, you think this is definitely one of the strengths of neuroanthropology, say, compared to a discipline like psychology?
I think so. I mean, psychology has some really strong things about it, and I think one of the things I admire most about psychology is its integration of applied practice and high-quality research. And anthropology has done that, but not to the same degree. And I think what neuroanthropology as an area really pretends to is to have that same sort of mesh of theory-driven research and applied practice. Because there are lots of ways to think about cultural variation, to think about problems like inequality or racism that are human problems. And anthropology has a piece to add there. And so does neuroscience. I was really struck. I was up in Montreal recently once again, and it was just a great place to visit. I went once more to the Montreal Neurological Institute, or the Neuro, as they call it. And Wild at Penfield, there's a big quote from outside, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the line, that the aim of neuroscience is to understand man himself. And that's a very similar sort of sentiment to anthropology. Yeah. And I think we hope through that understanding that we can then be in a position to also develop know-how, not just knowing about things, but know-how to do sort of novel approaches to dealing with a lot of problems we're facing.
Yeah, I think I really appreciate the contextualizing of the brain within the environment, because in neuroscience, the brain is usually all by itself. It's like
right.
The brain, you think about neuroscientists or, evil scientists with their laboratory and brains in jars. And
they wiggle their fingers and they're ready to manipulate you or do something like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this is a broader context, and actually taking, I guess, it seems more, a little bit more realistic, in the sense that we, with our senses, we are constantly touching our environment. We are in contact with everything around us at all times. Our brain is not turned off to it.
Exactly. And I think as we come to appreciate the sensory side of ourselves, or even now we're starting to realize how things like what we eat and the bacteria we have in our gut and the level of inflammation we have in our body, all these feedback into the brain in really fascinating ways. And I do think the direct implication is that this, at least in our society, this gives us more ways to understand that we need to do certain things to try to ameliorate those problems. Sometimes I'm a little cautious. One area that I both embrace and critical of is this whole notion that's gotten some popular press of poverty poisons the brain.
Yeah.
And it really resonates with people. There's poor kids, it's not their fault, their brains are being poisoned by the experience of social inequality. And it's clear the research shows that low socioeconomic status is linked to impaired cognitive function, less working memory, and this is linked to the experience of stress. So it's the stress that's causing some of these damaging effects, in this case, of neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we already know that there's a lot of poverty out there, and that, I'd be very hesitant that the best route is to just, invent new drugs to deal with problems. But there are people who talk about that. And
here, you're poor. Why don't we'll just fund a pill that you get that'll take care of the poverty thing. So you'll be happy and smart, still poor.
Exactly. Yeah.
that sounds really wrong.
Good.
Yeah. Do you think that that there is some kind of a solution that people are looking for in pharmacology for the poisoning effect? I mean, it seems as though we would go a lot further on the cultural side of things, actually helping people's situations so that in poverty-stricken areas, maybe we can reduce crime, maybe improve the education in those areas, so that even though there's poverty, there's still enough for people to be less stressed in their daily life.
Exactly. I think there are lots of low-hanging fruit that we could use, and not all of those are working to develop new pharmacological interventions. I mean, if we think about what we've learned about, steroids and trying to use steroids to address inflammation or stress in the brain or whatever it may be, steroids over the long term are not a good idea. They have all sorts of consequences and side effects. And yet having good teachers and having good funding, these are things that help help people grow, help your brain develop to its full potential. And so it's exciting. It's an exciting time to say we're in a position now to say, well, we understand a lot about the brain, and we can use the brain as a way to understand better the things that we need to do. But the brain, as you just said, comes with the body, comes with an environment. Mm-hmm. And unless you work with where the brain is at, which is a body and an environment and a cultural system, then you're not really getting the lessons of what the brain's about.
There's someone in the chat room, Mark Pelletier. He's another host here on the TWiT Network. He has a show called Futures in Biotech, and he said that there was a Nobel Prize winner in medicine, Mario Capecchi, who was homeless for 6 years as a child. He still won the Nobel Prize in medicine. So it does go to show that there is a certain, like, the discussion of neuroplasticity, even if he was homeless and did suffer some amount of damage, what we would consider damage as a result of that time in poverty, that obviously came back and didn't hold him back much.
Yeah, and this is actually something I would also critique anthropologists on. I mean, you get statements about, oh, social inequality, and I might even hinted at this myself, you know, is such a bad problem. That's what drives addiction. But then you start looking at the people, and it's not everyone's using the same amount of drugs. There's lots of variation on the ground. And trying to understand those pathways in many ways requires a developmental perspective to understand how people develop, how you can have incredible people come out of adverse circumstances or out of good circumstances. And mm-hmm. and that developmental perspective is so important to understanding, again, that the brain comes with a body and comes with a social environment.
Well, the brain comes with the body in a social environment, and this show does come with sponsors. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. It's come to you instantly even. It's pretty awesome. There are several easy ways that you can instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac or your PC or iPad through the iPad app. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch on your television. Additionally, things like the Roku box or Apple TV are inexpensive, easy to use set-top boxes that will also allow you to use and watch Netflix. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies as you want, TV shows as you want, anytime you want. And if you start watching a show on one device, you can stop at any point. Netflix keeps track of where you stopped watching so that you can pick up without missing a beat on another device at another time. Additionally, you can cancel at any time. So try Netflix today for free, 30 days. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for their free trial, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of TWiT and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Back to the show. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Lende. He is a neuroanthropologist. He has a blog on PLOS called Neuroanthropology. And we've been talking about the intersection of the brain and culture and how these two interesting areas of study are being melded, integrated together in this discipline. I'd love to talk a little bit about your blog and how you got your start blogging and what kind of things you, outside of the academic world, like to talk about in your blog.
Great. Yeah. The funny thing with starting the blog was it started as a collaboration between Greg Downey and myself. And Greg and I were in the same department at that point in time. And then Greg did that wonderful thing. He fell in love and got married and moved off to Australia.
A little far away.
And so we wanted to have a way to keep talking about the things we enjoy talking about. And so we decided to create this, at that time, just an individual blog so we could keep having conversations. And oddly enough, writing about it, I think appropriately enough, really helped us express our ideas better and to give us more of a response. I think we talked more about neuroanthropology and about our ideas by having to write about it and by being separate but having the shared medium for us to express ourselves. And that's how it started. What was really amazing about it was within a period of months, other people really started getting excited about what we were doing. And since it was all public, it wasn't
just a private conversation.
Right. It wasn't on the water cooler or as we were rushing to classes. Other people got excited about it, and people really started to pay attention to what we were writing about and to visit us and to comment us. And we started to realize that there was this whole ecosystem online and all these people that we could reach, neuroscientists, which anthropology departments often are not located very close to neuroscience departments. And using the blog, we could talk with these people more. And so it was just a great platform for us to do our work together, to reach a public, and to make the connections that we saw emerging from this area of intersection. So that's how it formed. And I think in terms of the other things I like to write about, my kids love video gaming. I love video gaming, so I'll write about video games every once in a while. And I love, I think the fun thing about blogs is they don't have to be one thing. If you're feeling like you want to post a funny video that day, you can post a funny video that day.
Right.
It's a lot more like teaching in that way, where you in teaching, you don't want to be on 100% of the time trying to deliver information. People can't stand that. And so you try to play it up. And I've learned that's the wonderful thing about working online is you can sort of make it up as you go, and what feels right, and you see how people respond to it. So that's fun.
Yeah. In terms of the connections that you've made, have you seen any collaborations come out of it that maybe wouldn't? Like you said, that, and it's true that many neuroscience departments are really far across campus from the anthropology department, and the people in these departments don't usually talk. But because you have the blog that you have people come together in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise?
I think so. I mean, we've used it in many ways as a vehicle to try to get more anthropologists interested in this type of work. And there, I think we've made tremendous progress. So we have an edited volume coming out from MIT Press. Mm-hmm. I was just really excited at the last major anthropology meetings last month that another young group of scholars took on the banner of neuroanthropology and organized a whole very fascinating session on possession and dissociation and entertainment. And so now we have a whole young group of scholars who are calling themselves neuroanthropologists. And I don't think that would have happened without the blog, because it was an easy way to reach a wide audience. I think with the neuroscientists, that's starting now. Greg definitely has some collaborative work, and as do I. And we're starting to make connections, for example, with the Foundation for Psychocultural Research, which has really pushed interdisciplinary neuroscience and psychological anthropology together. And I think there's going to be some exciting developments there, just in terms of being able to at least have the conversations. You got to start building relationships, I think, and from there build collaborations. And so I've been able to talk to leaders in, say, addiction, such as Peter Kalovitz, who's just a great, generous neuroscientist who and sometimes it disagrees with me, right? He's much more focused on, if we're talking about the habitual nature of drugs, how the once habits get started off, it's that they don't understand what's going on and that it's the side and the framing of it that matters. And to be able to have that kind of conversation through a written medium and then to share that with other people, then you can take that next step and see if there's work research you can do together.
You've recently been involved in some controversy as well. Governor Rick Scott singled out anthropology, and this is something that you were able, you talked about on your blog.
That's right. And so back in, I guess it's October now, Florida Governor Rick Scott said several times in public forums that, and Florida doesn't need any more anthropologists. There are no jobs for anthropologists in Florida. And this was really part
of... We've got enough. We need more lawyers, but we've got plenty of anthropologists.
Just... Oh, you actually wanted more scientists. You wanted more STEM funding, more science. biology, engineering, and mathematics. And the controversy erupted immediately because, first off, anthropology is very much a science, and anthropology also is having great job growth, as the U.S. Department of Bureau of Labor Statistics showed, much more than a lot of other fields. So we are a science. We do other things like humanistic inquiry at the same time, but we're very much a science, and we're having job growth. And so he was wrong on both counts. But the wonderful thing that came out of it was not just anthropologists, but particularly anthropologists came together and sort of, said, well, we need to show the public, including Rick Scott, that we do lots of things that make a difference alongside our more theoretical work. And there was a great presentation, This is Anthropology, put together by University of South Florida students that talked about all the applied work that they do in Florida. And all the difference that they're making in various ways. And, that went viral pretty quickly and was seen by 70,000 people.
Wow.
And I think that's the exciting thing that doing stuff online can help you do. So we had a really positive response to the Governor Scott controversy. But it's tough times. It's tough times for funding a public education. University of South Florida is a public university.
All over. There are tough times for the funding. And if researchers can, or if politicians can, put a bad face on some things, it makes it easier for them to cut, I think.
Right. And to scapegoat, whichever flavor of intellectual inquiry they might not agree with or might not understand how it contributes. And whether that's contributing in an economic sense or, I think, as many people said, to our fundamental understanding of who we are, I think that's what a lot of liberal arts do, but it's also what a lot of neuroscience does. And, I think there's just a lot of, say, bench science and neuroscience that probably wouldn't get funded if it were all about the job numbers it was supposed to be in. So it really cuts all ways when this sort of controversy erupts.
Yeah, and something like anthropology, I wonder if there is a general misperception of what anthropologists do. I mean, I have this, this idea of somebody who's going out and digging for Indian burial grounds or who's looking at artifacts from, different African cultures, but not really something that would affect us here and now.
Right. Well, I do have a fedora and a leather jacket.
Good. And a whip.
Once I was running across campus and some students started to do the theme from Indiana Jones.
Nice.
But anthropology really is what the word says. It's about the study of people. And that can be study of people in the past or study of people in the present. The study, had one major part of its foundational effort was to understand people in other cultures than our own. And yet that's grown as globalization has happened. We've realized that, there aren't that many quote-unquote isolated tribes anymore, and that changes things. So we need to understand these global processes, and those also lead back to doing work here at home to understand, the problems that we face at home using the same sort of, what anthropologists call holistic inquiry, but just, inquiry that will draw on biology, it will draw on language, it will draw on culture to understand variation wherever we face it.
And I think now, with the online realm growing, there's probably a huge burgeoning field for digital anthropology.
It's exciting. Really exciting. You have people studying World of Warcraft and people studying Second Life. I think people studying this sort of endeavor, this is a whole new form of communication. It builds on old forms, but it's we couldn't have done this even a few years ago like this. And this means that the way we work as a society has changed. And that's one area that anthropology really focuses on. How does society function? And in some cases, the neuroscience doesn't help there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's much more, it's a level of organization where the sort of the particular perspective of neuroscience might not be as applicable, particularly right now. But it's fascinating. I would love to put together a study on video gaming in the future, just because I think it brings together some of these elements about that sense of engagement and the meaning that it has. I mean, I watch my sons who are starting to reach their teen years, and this is the way young boys talk. For me, it was comic books, but they talk about video games, and so it's a cultural form. But myself, I can be accused of having clicked one too many times on the mouse. And so this is part of the way we live now. And anthropology is interested in those questions. That's, I think, in one sense, that's what anthropology does, is it studies the way people live. And these online forums are such, have swept the globe, really, and changed a lot of the way we're living right now.
Yeah, someone in the chat room was saying that they think the world is becoming more tribal and clannish. Do you see that happening? And do you see the online space kind of opening things up and allowing more connectivity?
I don't think it's going to be an either or. I think both things are happening. Certainly, we're having this incredible reach through the internet, through commerce, through transportation, for people to communicate, to interact, to share ideas, to repress other people as well, to do violent things. That has a global reach that's really different from the way we did before. But at the same time, it's just, this is how cultural meaning works. You know, people, if you're on one side, I'm on the other side, I will define myself in reaction to that. And I think you're seeing a lot of emergence of new forms of diversity that are really fascinating. Who would know about something like furries on Second Life? These people love to have their avatars who are animal-like. Yet, you can go back to cultural anthropology research and you find similar themes in many societies around the world. So full circle there.
Interesting. I know I personally have been to Burning Man several years in the past and for over many years, not long in the past. But I think that interest, people talk about tribes a lot at Burning Man, and I think it would be really interesting to see how the experience of Burning Man, this ephemeral event that you start out with, nothing pretty much, and then it grows, and then suddenly everything's gone. How that affects the brain, how it affects spatial learning, spatial memory, if there are any ephemeral changes during that event.
That's a great project. And in fact, there's a young researcher, Megan, who presented her work examining this form of play, as she calls it, on Burning Man and using a neuroanthropology approach to try to understand some of what comes up. Burning Man is also really fascinating because it shows how much our notion of culture has changed. You know, it's no longer this tribal sort of thing where it's this one identity you have. People go to Burning Man, they really participate, they're really into that, and then they go back to other lives. And as we study social and cultural life more and more, we realize that people do that much more than we used to think, that we... Mm-hmm. We can have multiple identities, that we can build constructs where the social situation and the identity you have in that situation are really important, and then you can change roles and go on. And so that challenges the sort of monolithic idea of culture. And you see that even in the cultural neuroscience research, which is great stuff. And they started out using that sort of monolithic comparison of, what are Eastern brains, Asian brains versus sort of Western or U.S. brains like. And it was a good place to start to document that there were differences in the way brains are structured and the way they function. But they realized that you can't have that sort of monolithic culture just because there are so many things like Burning Man and people travel and so forth.
It's fascinating. Our culture is constantly changing. Things are, as you've said, there's this diversity that's growing, and it just it It's such a fascinating, fascinating area of study. And just thank you so much for joining me this hour on the program. I've really appreciated getting to talk to you.
Kiki, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And if anyone is interested in more neuroanthropology, you can go to Daniel's, Dr. Lende's PLOS blog, which is blogs.plos.org/neuroanthropology, and read up on some of the stuff that, we've been talking about here today. It's just some great stuff. I gotta do more reading. I need more time for reading during the days. That's it for our hour today. Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is just about over. But, you know, I will be back next week and we'll be talking about the oceans. Wonderful talk. I love the oceans. Until then, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki on Twitter and on Facebook. Kiki Sanford on Google Plus. You can go to my website, drkiki.tv. You can email me at drkiki@drkiki.tv. And you can even find past episodes of this show on the internet if you go to twit.tv/Kiki. You can also go to iTunes and download them there. Additionally, if you want more great sciencey goodness, I also have This Week in Science, another program about weekly science news that airs on Thursday, 7 p.m. Pacific time here on the Twit Network, which you can find at twist.org. And I also do the Science Chat on Fridays, a very casual conversation, chatting about whatever you want to chat about. Fridays, 12 noon Pacific time on JustinTV/Dr. Kiki. I will see you next week. I think that about does it. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. All I ask is 1 hour a week. And remember, 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Thank you so much for watching. Now for your science meditation of the week.
We have built a virtual slow motion camera where we can see photons or light particles moving through space. Now, you have seen Doc Edgerton's pictures of a bullet through an apple. But photons travel about a million times faster than bullets. So our camera can see these photons or bullets of light traveling through space.
We use a very regular pulsed light source and a camera that is not one camera, but an array of 500 sensors, each triggered at a trillionth of a second delay. So even though each of our sensors is slow, we can still capture a fast movie. I'm standing next to our laboratory setup here. This is our camera. Objective is in the front here. The body of the camera is much larger than what you would expect from a regular camera like the one over here. Our light source is a titanium sapphire laser that's over here. And it emits a beam of very, very short pulses. And that those pulses are then directed to the scene with these mirrors. Now, our camera only sees one dimension, so it makes a fast movie, but it makes a fast movie of one line of the scene only. And in order to fix that, we have these two mirrors here. We look at the scene via these two mirrors, and when we rotate this upper mirror here, we actually see different lines of the scene. So what's happening is the camera keeps taking images, and we very slowly rotate this mirror to scan our field of view across the entire scene. And because all of our pulses look the same, we can in the end go and combine all these images that we took to get one complete movie of the scene.
Such a camera may be useful in medical imaging, in industrial or scientific use, and in the future even for consumer photography. In medical imaging, now we can do ultrasound with light because we can analyze how light will scatter volumetrically inside the body. In industrial imaging, one can use the scattered light to analyze defects in materials. And in consumer photography, we are always fascinated with creating lighting effects that appear to come from very sophisticated light sources. But because we can watch photons seemingly moving through the space, we can analyze the transport, the movement of these photons, and create new photographs as if we had created those expensive light sources in a studio.
That does it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Isn't that awesome? Photons of light. It's mind-boggling.